Most superheroes, for good reasons, have secret identities. Yet the same holds true for regular humans, even famous ones. Sometimes, though, those identities are foisted on them. Hi, I'm Dan Webster, host of Movies 101. And on this week's show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I will discuss two movies that deal with the theme of identity, its origins and meanings. We'll discuss the revisionist look at poet Emily Dickinson, Wild Nights with Emily, and the reimagined Superman origin story, Brightburn. So don't touch that dial, because another edition of Movies 101 is coming up next, right here on Spokane Public Radio.
Since its debut in 1985, Les Misérables has held the stage worldwide. This musical phenomenon returns to Spokane this August as part of the West Coast Entertainment Best of Broadway series. Our four Spokane Public Radio June membership drawings are for pairs of tickets to see this Les Mis revival featuring new staging and reimagined scenery. Make your pledge of support now at SpokanePublicRadio.org or call during business hours 800-328-5729. Sustainers are in all drawings, and while no pledge is needed to enter the drawings, public radio lives because of your support. About to start with tomorrow comes.
Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbinder, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and film and music editor for The Inlander.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that has embraced the same identity for two decades now. Some of the faces have changed, and two, we now look at what's streaming on our respective services nearly as much as we haunt area movie theaters. That said, our discussions still involve a search for quality cinema no matter where we can find it. This past week, we stuck to theaters and saw two films that offer up different views of familiar cultural icons. One was a real person, the poet Emily Dickinson, whose identity was given a makeover by writer-director Madeleine Olneck in her biopic, Wild Nights with Emily. The other is Brightburn, an alternate look at the Superman myth, if Superman's secret identity were more Ted Bundy than Clark Kent. Let's begin with a bit of poetry. Sometime during her writing career, the Amherst, Massachusetts poet Emily Dickinson wrote the following lines: wild nights, were I with thee, wild nights should be our luxury. Dickinson, who lived between 1830 and 1886, is famous for several things: being a recluse, suffering from depression, carrying a long-held torch for someone commonly assumed to be a man, and writing some 1,800 poems, less than a dozen that saw publication in her lifetime. But how true is that identity? Writer-director Madeleine Olneck, adapting the work of scholars over the past two decades, doing original research on Dickinson's poetry, including spectrographic studies of the actual written poems themselves, says no. Dickinson, appears, was far less of a recluse than popularly perceived, maybe not depressed at all, and instead of carrying a torch for a man, usually referred to only as the master, was actually in love with her sister-in-law, Susan Gilbert Dickinson. Olneck affects a blend of the comic and the sober to tackle Dickinson's story, a tone compounded by her casting of former Saturday Night Live cast member Molly Shannon in the title role. But comedy aside, Olneck's intent at reframing Dickinson's story is totally serious.
Perhaps this will be heresy, but I must acknowledge right up front that I've never been a huge fan of Emily Dickinson's poetry.
Ooh,
mic drop. Okay. But I have to say, I really enjoyed this film, and I think that's true for a variety of reasons. One, it does seem to have some basis in fact, but that fact does not constrain this film in any way, because it is almost a romantic comedy. And I think that certainly Molly Shannon, being cast as Emily Dickinson, who everyone will recognize from her iconic work on Saturday Night Live, she adds to that whole like comedic sense of what's going on here. But I hope this movie is true. I hope that she did have this life beyond what we've been led to believe was her fate, because she certainly deserved to have a reactive depression to coming of age during this time period where women's work was undervalued. And also, I hope she did have a sweetie, because throughout her poetry, we can see this longing for different things. And I hope one of them was for a really special person in her life.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned Wild Nights with Emily being inspired by fact. And they do say at the end that Emily's niece actually wrote a sort of kind of biography shortly after Dickinson died and became a literary phenomenon, basically explaining, like, she wasn't what you think she was. She wasn't this spinster that never left the house. And the movie shows us how those misconceptions could have been furthered along just because she didn't want to come out of her room because she didn't like the people that were downstairs or something like that. And so I thought that was an interesting way of going after this. And I liked this movie too, and I liked it as a sort of companion piece, but a completely different kind of movie to A Quiet Passion, which was right. the Terrence Davis film starring Cynthia Nixon as Emily Dickinson.
Which follows a much more standard, familiar storyline.
It's Terrence Davis, yeah. So of course yeah. it's sober. But I think that both movies show Emily Dickinson's struggles with sexism of the time, with these male editors and publishers who either wanted to take an eraser to her poetry, to publish it anonymously, to title it, which mm-hmm. she didn't title any of her poems, and they ran them with titles. But I think that each movie, Quiet Passion and Wild Nights with Emily, portray her personal life in completely, vastly different ways. And I liked that. I was expecting from the trailers, which have been running at the Magic Lantern for what seems like years now, I was expecting this to be maybe more farcical, like a kind of mm-hmm. noises off style, doors opening, doors closing, kind of upstairs, downstairs mm-hmm. sort of comedy.
Molly Shannon and falling into a chair.
Yeah, and it isn't like that. But it is funny. There is comedy in this. And a lot of the comedy comes from just the sheer cluelessness of mostly the men that are around Emily Dickinson mm-hmm. and just how they're running everything, but they're so completely inept and talentless. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think that you see that in Emily Dickinson's poetry, too. There is humor in there. It just took way too long for people to figure out that she was funny. You know, she'd occasionally write about death, but she was funny, too.
The really interesting thing, I think, about Olnick's screenplay is the fact that she makes the woman who had an affair with Dickinson's brother, Austin Dickinson, I mean, she never married him. She was married to someone else.
And she's played by Amy Simons in
right,
the film.
Mabel Loomis Todd.
Yeah.
She's almost as big a character in this film as Dickinson is herself.
She's
the narrator. And she's the one who first had access to the poetry that was found after Dickinson's death, the huge trove of poetry. And she's the one who, at least in Olnick's version of it, is the one who most likely was the one who was erasing Susan's name,
and
the real lover, out of all the poems.
And the main joke of Wild Nights with Emily is that Mabel is the one who, as you said, is narrating the film, because there's kind of a running thing where she's talking to this ladies' literary society.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get flashbacks to Emily Dickinson when she was alive. The joke is that she's the one that, according to the film, was perpetrating all these misconceptions
right.
about Emily Dickinson. So there is this commentary about what people say about us after we die and
right.
how history can
right.
has
this
been.
This oral
you know.
History took over.
Yeah.
I agree. I was a little skeptical based on the trailers about Molly Shannon's ability to pull this off because, frankly, to me, she will always be Mary Catherine Gallagher from Saturday Night Live. And if you haven't seen that particular performance,
on YouTube, it's
you
all there.
Should, yeah, definitely check it out. But for whatever reason, I think she was ideally cast in
yeah.
this particular film. And also, the actress who plays Susan Gilbert Dickinson was really excellent.
Well, I wanted to talk about Molly Shannon a little bit because this doesn't feel as much of a showcase for a performance the way that A Quiet Passion felt for Cynthia Nixon. But I think that in Wild Nights with Emily, Molly Shannon gets a lot to do because she does get to be kind of quietly funny. She gets to be sort of withering towards the people that are belittling her. She does get to have these romantic scenes and these dramatic scenes. And then she has scenes where she looks directly in the camera and reads Emily Dickinson's poetry, which I was kind of expecting to not really take to. But I actually like that approach a lot because it's not a fourth wall breaking. It's like a 3.5 wall breaking. And I actually kind of liked that approach. And I don't know why we haven't seen her and stuff. I mean, the only thing I can think is that she's just a woman of a certain age and it's Hollywood. So, you know, she hasn't been getting starring roles and things. But she's been really good in other indie movies. I would direct people towards a movie called Year of the Dog, which was a Mike White film in which she's this lonely woman whose dog dies. And it's sort of how she deals with the grief of that. And then a movie from a few years ago called Other People, where she plays a woman who's dying of cancer and her gay son comes back home to help her. It's this autobiographical film. And she's terrific in both of those movies. And so I hope that this, because this is kind of like the first big starring role she's had in a long time, and this movie has been getting played in a lot of theaters, I hope that this puts Molly Shannon back on people's radar because she was a huge breakout star on SNL. I mean, and mainly for those kind of slapsticky, fall down physical type performances. And the fact that she can do that and be so funny at it and then do a performance like the one she does in in Wild Nights with Emily shows that she's a really a well-rounded performer.
And there are a lot of close-up shots in this particular film. And you can just see the slight changes in her expression that just tell you everything about what's going on.
Yeah, it's a very expressive performance. Yeah.
If you have questions on what Olnick or her take on the whole Dickinson thing, there's a 1998 New York Times story, and you can find it online, and it's titled Beethoven's Hair. And it talks about these spectrographic studies that go back, or these all these different kinds of studies that go back and tell us a behind-the-scenes story of people such as Beethoven and many other people. But in, there's a long section there about the studies of the actual manuscripts, the actual pieces of paper on which Dickinson wrote, and it talks about how they were able to look at it and pick up that there was erasures and changes. Yeah. And it's a fascinating story. It's a long read, but my wife likes long reads. So I would say that it's not just imagination. What Olnick did here, there is a basis in fact. It's arguable, but what thing involving art and artists is not
and
arguable.
And it's so long ago, and you know, she wasn't a person of interest when she was alive, and so it makes sense that they wouldn't have documented her personal life in the way that, you know, they would have documented somebody like Beethoven or Mozart, who were famous in their lifetime. Right. And the movie Wild Nights with Emily actually ends with text on the screen saying the Dickinson Estate or the Dickinson Museum, whatever it is, they actually allowed us to take photographs of these manuscripts. And so we actually get to see them at the end. We get to see
the erasers.
She wrote in pencil. And so it was easy to erase apparently Susan's name out of it. And I thought that was actually a really cool way to end this movie.
Mm-hmm. And that was Wild Nights with Emily. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at Brightburn. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio. And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed Wild Nights with Emily. Let's now move to another film about identity, this one being not so much rediscovered as completely reimagined. It was way back in 1938 that writer Jerry Siegel and artist Joe Shuster created one of the most iconic superheroes ever, that of the being from the doomed planet Krypton who became that symbol of truth, justice, and the American way known as Superman. But what if instead of truth and justice, the being at the age of puberty underwent dark psychopathic changes? That's the concept behind Brightburn, a film directed by David Yarovesky from a script by the cousins Brian and Mark Gunn. Set in the Kansas farm town of Brightburn, shades of Superman's farm town of Smallville, Yaroveski's film centers on Corey and Kyle Breyer, played by Elizabeth Banks and David Denman, whose 12-year-old son Brandon, played by Jackson A. Dunn, suddenly starts acting weird. Seems like his actions are tied to the glowing red thing locked up in the family barn. And it seems that glowing thing is tied to how the Breyers obtained Brandon in the first place. And all of this is clearly tied to Brandon's growing thirst for what? Acceptance? Love? Power? Even darker urges? Hard to say, though it's a thirst that leads to disaster. Yet even if the concept is bursting with potential, Yaroveski and his team choose to ignore the metaphysical possibilities in favor of focusing on graphic, at times stomach-lurching, scenes of violence that will appeal mostly to fans of Saw and Hostel, and to those who embrace what's aptly known as torture porn. How's that for the new American way?
Well, I really like the concept at the center of Brightburn, and that's essentially what if Superman were a little boy serial killer? And I'm sure that's how they pitched it, and they got the financing to put this out, but I was really disappointed in the finished result.
There's so much potential.
I know. Because this is basically, what this boils down to, is this is basically a supervillain origin story, but it doesn't have any origin in it, because the movie begins with this couple, played by Elizabeth Banks and David Denman, and they're having a hard time conceiving. And in the middle of the night, these tremors rock their house, and the movie literally cuts to 12 years later, and they suddenly have a little boy, and they're talking about, oh, we were so happy when we adopted you. And of course, we know that something's up and something came down.
Because we know
that,
Ma and Pa Kent, what they did.
Exactly.
Yes.
And so it's kind of playing upon those basic comic book tropes that we all know, especially at this point. We see like some home movie footage of the little boy, but then he goes from zero to good son in no time flat, because the movie basically starts up and he's 12 years old at this point, and he's suddenly bad all of a sudden, and he just starts killing anybody that gets in his way, and he has this ski mask that his eyes can burn holes through things, and he has super strength and he can fly. And I'm thinking, okay, that's interesting. And then the movie jumps back in time to show us that same night again, but from a different angle. And it doesn't tell us anything at all. And by the time the movie was over, I was no closer to understanding who this little kid is, what his powers are, where he came from. I mean, I don't necessarily need them to sit down and give me a Wikipedia summary, but I need something, because this is basically just The Omen, except Damien can fly and has super strength, and I don't really find that all that interesting. And if this was supposed to be some kind of allegory for puberty or adolescence, it doesn't really explore any of that either. And so you're right, it just kind of devolves into one scene after another of people home alone, and the lights flicker off and they come back on, and the little boy is standing in the background, and then the lights flicker off again and come back on, and now he's vanished and he's flying all over the place.
And then blood and gore.
And then blood and gore.
And blood and gore and graphic, I have to say.
It's pretty gnarly, this movie Brightburn, but I didn't mind the violence so much. I don't think it's quite as bad as made it out
please.
To be. I've seen worse.
Okay, I'm just going to say and then we'll leave it at that.
Yeah, right, exactly.
I agree that the problem with this film is Brightburn had a good concept underlying it, and that's why it turns out to be such a missed opportunity.
Yeah.
And it also had good acting talent, and production value was high for this type of movie and so forth. But I'm thinking that it would have been better served by less violence, which I thought was largely gratuitous. I mean, different from John Wick 3.
You didn't like the close-up of the shard of glass being pulled out of the eyeball?
That is what I said.
I don't need certain images in my mind.
Okay, and here's the problem. I think it would have been much spookier and much more of an effective horror film if much more of this would have happened behind the scenes, because that's what is really frightening to people, the things that you don't know. Mm-hmm. But this was just so over the top in that regard. And as you said, it just sort of squandered these opportunities to make larger statements and about toxic masculinity, what
rural
that might
America.
Look like,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
What this longing and yearning for a child, how that encompasses people's lives.
The Omen touches on that too.
Sure.
It's kind of the same setup. And honestly, like, I don't walk into a movie like this hoping it has some grander statement to make about anything, frankly. But I mean, they're setting up these things and then they're not paying them off. And it also doesn't help that just the basic plot, the ABCs of the story, don't connect. It's almost like things were hacked out of it at random, because it just jumps from one thing to another without any logic, without dramatic logic or just
intelligence. You can imagine at the script conferences, somebody said, well, we'll just get to that during the sequel, because you know this whole thing is building up to Brightburn 2.
And I don't know if that's going to happen.
It has not been well received.
No, and this is something that I've really grown tired of, because we've seen this happen a lot, where a movie gets made and it's clearly supposed to be a franchise starter. And usually when that happens, and they just say, we'll get to it when we have more money in part two, and we'll explain all the stuff that we just didn't bother explaining in the first one, usually that doesn't go over very well. Remember The Mummy, which was supposed to start the Universal Dark Universe or whatever it was called? I mean, I think you should probably wait and see how people receive your movie before you decide that you're going to make 2, 3, and 4 sight unseen. They were going to do that with those stupid Guy Ritchie King Arthur movies. They were going to make like 6 of those. So the problem with Brightburn is that, like we've talked about, the hook at the center of it is a good one, but it doesn't do anything with it. And so we're sitting there going, well, who is this kid? Mm-hmm. Has he been? I had a lot of questions. Is this the first time that his childhood has just been completely idyllic and uneventful up until this point? Now he's just exhibiting all of these powers? I mean, I think that's what they're trying to get at. There's this glowing red thing in the barn. And when we find out what it is, we think, why did his parents, his adoptive parents, hang on to that? Why wouldn't you get rid of that?
Yeah. I don't know where you would put it, though, as a practical matter.
In the woods or something? I don't know. He's in a public school. Did he come down from outer space with a social security card? How does he even get enrolled in a public school? If he's trying to keep his identity a secret, why does he keep notebooks full of obvious clues as to his identity just lying around for anyone to pick up?
He has a
signature that the sheriff picks up on right away. But then once everything comes to a head, it's just splatter time.
Yeah.
And it's like they set up all these things and then don't really have the intelligence or the wherewithal to pay them off. So it just goes right into special effects.
Well, and I think that it was interesting because Guardian of the Galaxy's James Gunn is the producer of this. And
his brother is the screenwriter, and his cousin is the screenwriter.
Right, but those franchises like mix humor and horror and fantasy and all these things really adeptly. And that is part of the problem here. I actually liked Elizabeth Banks in Brightburn.
Me too.
Because we're accustomed to seeing her in The Hunger Games and in all these comedic sort of roles, over-the-top sort of roles. And she was your basic mom in this particular role. But I think her being cast also led me to have the expectation that maybe there would be some levity in this particular movie.
Well, and I thought that she and David Denman, who's probably best known from The Office, he plays her husband here. I thought that they were actually convincing in these roles, as convincing as they could be.
Yeah.
I also believed that, and this is something that movies, especially movies like this, usually fail at this. I believed their skepticism. They caught on faster than characters in these kind of movies usually catch on. It still took them a little too long. When you find out that your kid is some kind of supervillain, obviously you're not going to believe that. But once they're faced with the evidence that
they're willing to take the necessary steps.
But there's still that skepticism there. And I thought that they conveyed that really well, which is why it's so disappointing that the movie itself doesn't have more to say about what they're feeling, has more to say about how the world at large would react to this, or even the town. I mean, and maybe it was budget constraints. I don't know. But I don't know if we're getting a Brightburn too, but that's clearly what they were thinking.
Have you seen this kid Jackson A. Dunn before?
Not that I know of.
Yeah, he's been in a lot of TV and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I thought he was terrific.
He is good. And that's,
he had those dead Ted Bundy eyes.
He does. But again, you know, he's kind of, this switch just keeps kind of being flipped on and off seemingly at random.
Hey, this kid's never bled. He's never bled. Oh, my God.
They've never noticed that before?
Yeah, really,
you know?
Exactly.
I mean, come on.
How about the kids he's played with at school, his teachers and PE coach?
Think about this for more than 5 seconds and it totally falls apart.
Yeah, exactly. And that was Brightburn. This is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster. And earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbinder, Mary Pat Truthart, and I discussed Wild Nights with Emily. Let's take this moment to thank Jim Tevin for both producing and engineering the show, and we thank you, too, our loyal listeners. And we invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again go searching for the best of cinema wherever we can find it. Until then, remember these words spoken by Ophelia in Shakespeare's tragedy Hamlet. Lord, we know what we are, but not what we may be. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.